It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at what's making headlines in Wisconsin this week in our weekly news roundup.
First, in 1982, a Roman Catholic nun named Sister Helen Prejean began corresponding with a prisoner on death row at the Louisiana State Penitentiary. His name was Patrick Saunier. Their correspondence led to an intense relationship as Sister Helen became his spiritual advisor and helped Patrick appeal his death sentence.
That relationship was also the beginning of Sister Helen's career as an outspoken activist against the death penalty. A decade later, she published an account of her experience called Dead Man Walking, a term used to describe convicts waiting for execution.
The book was adapted into a film by the same name, starring Sean Penn and Susan Sarandon, and in 2000 was transformed into an opera by composer Jake Heggie.
Dead Man Walking, the opera, has been called a modern classic and one of the most important and powerful operas ever written. And it's in Wisconsin for the first time ever, playing at the Overture Center in Madison today and Sunday.
Sister Helen Prejean is in the studio with us now, along with the composer of the opera, Jake Heggie. Sister Helen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And Jake, wonderful to have you as well.
It's a great pleasure.
Well, the book and the opera, Sister Helen, were both born out of your initial decision to write to a man that you'd never met before, a man on death row, and his name was Patrick. Can you tell us how you made that decision to go ahead with this? You were working with the poor, but you weren't working with death row inmates.
No, and I also didn't realize that he was going to be executed. I began writing to him at the invitation of someone who worked in the Louisiana Prison Coalition. Hey, says to Helen, you want to write to a death row inmate and be a pen pal? I said, sure. And I didn't know that 2 years later he was going to be executed in the electric chair, much less that I'd be there, because we hadn't had an execution, even in the deep south states, for 20 years. There'd been a moratorium. So I wrote. And then he wrote back, so then I visited. And then a little over 2 years later, I was there with him when they killed him in the electric chair, and it changed my life.
And a lot of other lives who went along on that journey with you. And in those early days, you write about when you were exchanging letters, you were surprised by the sort of the humanity that was shining through in these letters. He didn't mention his crime. But do you remember what that meeting was like when you finally made the jump from letters to face-to-face?
Yeah, it was very scary because, see, I was working at an adult learning center for dropouts, helping people get jobs. I was in a poor neighborhood. So I thought, I'll do a little in-run. Sometimes I could go see him because he didn't seem to have anybody visiting him. When I got to that prison, and you look up, and there's this big old green sign that by stepping onto prison property, you subjected yourself to this body search, dog sniffing, and it scared me. So then the guards start bringing me. Scary. They really do kind of capture this in the opera. I mean, it's clanging metal and stuff. And then they locked me in a room, said, well, go get your man. Then I started being nervous about him because I'd never really met face-to-face somebody who had murdered somebody. Went through that whole first visit. He didn't talk about his crime. But when I looked through that heavy mesh metal screen and I looked into his eyes, I saw a human being. And I went, oh, my God, he's human. I thought murderers would look different or something. And it all began then. That's where the journey really began. I saw his humanness. I remember thinking everybody's worth more than the worst thing they ever did. And then my journey began, which included then descending into the crime and seeing that he and his brother in cold blood had killed two innocent teenage kids.
And you had to figure out how to make sense of that and still see the humanity in this man that you've gotten to know
right.
as a person. You saw him all the way to the end, his execution, which you tried to prevent, but it didn't happen.
No, it didn't. It was unbelievable to me that they really were going to kill him. But in there, when I found out about the murder, I made a really bad mistake about the murder victims' families. I thought of those parents who had seen their kids go off that on a Friday night to a football game and they never saw them alive again. And then I thought, well, they're not going to want to see me because I'm the spiritual advisor to the two who had killed their kids. And I stayed away. I didn't even write them a note. I'm so sorry about your daughter. I'm so sorry about your son. And I met them. at the worst possible time you could meet a victim's family, because it was during the pardon board hearing, where you couldn't be more polarized. Because when you walk into a pardon board hearing, which was the last step before an execution, 1 week before Pat's execution, you sign the book when you go in, if you're on the life side or the death side, and all the victim's family's there to see justice happen, is what they've been told. And I was one of the only ones in there with one or two other people to ask the clemency board not to kill this man. And that's when I met the victim's family. And the tension was terrible because I had done it all wrong. And, of course, the opera picks that up because it's real. It's what really happened.
You've changed the way you do things between now and then, and I want to get to that in a little bit. But I also want to get to the opera. You have a remarkable collaborator here. You've taken this incredible story full of anguish and brutality, and you put it on the opera stage. Now, those aren't things that are unique to the opera stage. There's murder and suicide all the time in opera, but there's something that's incredibly visceral about this opera. Jake, how did you go about approaching it?
Well, first of all, was to watch the movie, read the book, internalize the movie, internalize the book, and then forget about all of it and find a way to tell it on the stage. And that meant a great collaborator, which we had in the playwright Terrence McNally. One of our great American playwrights, Tony Award winner, has written plays, books to musicals, and now a libretto. And he thought about it a lot and decided on an order of pacing in the opera that would be very theatrical and would allow for many different kinds of music and different kinds of expression as we got to know these characters and their journeys along the way. And he created a framework and a structure that allowed us to go really deep into not only the experience, the physical experiences, but also the feelings of these people. Opera is first and foremost about feelings and emotions that stem from conflicts. And goodness knows this story has a lot of conflict, you know. And so it felt right in the tradition of great grand operas in terms of the big emotions, the big conflicts, the big stirrings, and the transformative power of music to carry the day. And so it had everything that we were looking for: an American story that felt universal, a story of our time that felt timeless, and a story that would fill an opera house and would make sense for people to sing. So all of those elements were part of it, but really working with a great writer like Terrence McNally, a man of the theater who understands what music can do in an opera, that was very, very key to the whole experience.
And it's a young opera, but it's already being called a classic. And I don't want to tantalize people anymore. I want to give people a taste of what it sounds like. This is a clip of Joseph, and he stands in, he's, I guess, a composite of several of the people that you've worked with, yes. Sister Helen. And this is a clip from his first aria in the opera, and he's singing about his relationship with Sister Helen. Let's listen.
Lay your head on her breast, and she tells you everything is gonna be all right. Everything is gonna be all right. Everything is gonna be.
Clip there from the opera Dead Man Walking. That's the aria from Joseph, the inmate on death row. And Jake, you hear America in that music. It sounds like
you.
America. And you also hear this hope and an emotion, the emotion that you feel. And I'm curious about how, listening to this now for Sister Helen and for you, how you hear that opera now. Now, it's not the same thing as staging, you know, La Traviata, you know, from ages ago, you know, relatively speaking. This really happened. Sister
yes.
Helen, you know, knew these men. Mm-hmm. She worked alongside them. She loved them. And how does that aspect of it play out when you hear this aria, Jay?
Well, in that particular moment, it's during their first meeting at the prison, and Joseph is actually testing her patience, but also opening his heart in a way about what mattered to him and what gave him happiness and pleasure that is gone from his life now. So there's a resignation to that aria too. It's very complicated, and a great singing actor brings it out. In Madison, we have the amazing Michael Mays, who really embodies the character in a way I've really never seen or heard. He's absolutely incredible. But there, you know, all the characters in this piece, some of them know what they want, some of them aren't quite sure. They think they've been told what they want, and others, you know, are being cagey with it. And Sister Helen is sort of negotiating through all of this. And the music can give us those complicated emotions and those many sides of what they're feeling and thinking or trying to get, and that sometimes even surprises them. But listening to it now, it's, you know, I was 38 years old when I wrote this. I'd never written an opera before. And now I'm 53, and I look back at it and I think, you know, I would write it completely different now. But it was such an interesting period of time. Well, you know, you become a different person over the years, and creatively, certainly my voice has changed. And I listen to it now, and I really appreciate the honesty of the writing, that it's very American, that it's very real, that it's very lyrical, that it's very honest, that it's very forthright, and that it gives the character a real chance to describe his state of mind.
And we'll come back and we'll get Sister Helen's take on how she feels hearing this, her story brought to music and to life and spread all over the world. We are speaking with the author of Dead Man Walking, Sister Helen Prejean, and the composer of the opera Dead Man Walking, Jake Heggie. The opera is being performed for the first time in Wisconsin by Madison Opera. It's tonight and Sunday at the Overture Center.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you have any questions for Sister Helen about her experience or her activism against the death penalty? Have you read the book or seen the opera? Or do you have a question about how you convert that story into an opera? Call and tell us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation after a look at the latest news with Michael Leland.
A European team of military observers who were traveling across eastern Ukraine have been detained by pro-Russian forces. That word comes from a representative of the separatists. The team was traveling with the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. A spokeswoman for the self-proclaimed separatist mayor of the town where they're being held says the group was carrying suspicious materials. U.S. officials are not confirming reports from North Korea that another American citizen is in custody there. The North's official news agency says the man entered the country 2 weeks ago with a tourist visa, but that he tore it up and shouted that he wanted to seek asylum. It says he's been detained for a gross violation of North Korea's legal order. And after all of this past winter's snow and the spring rains, you might be surprised to hear parts of Wisconsin are in a drought. But it's true. The U.S. Drought Monitor says almost 18% of the state's land area is abnormally dry or worse. It was even worse in January, when almost 60% of the state was considered to be in a drought. For Central Time, I'm Michael Leland.
We talk about issues in the news and topics that improve the quality of our lives.
This is one of those issues where you can get everyone from Occupy Wall Street to the Tea Party to agree on.
There's so much polarization in the state and the country around politics. I think it's just really uplifting and refreshing to people to get to sit down and just talk respectfully with each other.
Add your voice to the mix of lively guests with different perspectives.
The Joy Cardine Show, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from the Minnesota Marine Art Museum in Winona, presenting through June 29th, The Floating World, ukiyo-e prints from the Loren Rogers Museum of Art, highlighting the enchantment of historical Japanese prints. More at mmam.org. Support also comes from Rockweiler Insulation, dedicated to maximizing the energy efficiency of homes and businesses throughout southern Wisconsin through insulating and air sealing. On the web at rockweilerinsulation.com.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back with the author of Dead Man Walking, Sister Helen Prejean, and Jake Heggie, the composer of the opera adaptation of Dead Man Walking. And the opera is being performed for the first time in Wisconsin through Madison Opera tonight and Sunday at the Overture Center.
And we'd like to hear from you. Dead Man Walking has been considered one of the most powerful pieces of literature to address capital punishment, and Sister Helen has been one of the most outspoken activists against it. Do you have questions about her experiences, about her thoughts about the death penalty, or about the opera? call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
And Sister Helen, before we went to the news there, we were talking about this is lifted from your life. This is a page of your life story and your journey. How does it feel to you hearing it now? Has anything changed for you?
No, that particular scene that we just heard, where he begins to talk about, you know, a warm woman and a cold bottle of beer. Let me get this straight. And what it was like to just be in the company of a woman. And because I let them go to any place they needed to go, because they're regarded as monsters, and we're ratcheting toward their death, where they're getting 1,000 signals that they're nothing but disposable human waste. So sometimes it would be, and this could even be in the last day of their life, they would talk about ordinary things like how their mama fixed a stew, or it could be that when he was in a place of love with somebody, or it could be. And I didn't try to monitor it or censor it. I wanted them to know their dignity and that they were far more than the worst thing they'd ever done. So I think Jake captured something very special in that song. And it's almost verbatim of what one of the death row inmates, Robert Lee Willie, told me on the very day that he was executed.
You've done something that a lot of people at least feel that they couldn't do. Sit down with a murderer who had done something heinous. In this case, the first inmate that you were spiritual advisor to, he and his brother abducted a young couple, raped the girl, shot them in the back of the head, left them to die. And you saw him, and you were able somehow to look past that, and not only to look past that, but to have this sort of transcendent relationship. How did you do that? How did you ever look past the details of that murder and see that person?
You know what? I'm not sure about the looking past. It was kind of like holding myself in the outrage of what he had done, and then at the same time holding that he's a human being. It's a tremendous tension, like a riptide in your own soul. And I carried that tension all the way through. Once I knew what he and his brother had done, I could never look in his eyes again. But the humanness of a person takes over. There is a transcendence. People are more than that act. There was goodness in him. There was kindness in him. There was gratitude in him for everything that I did for him. And so it's a strange place. It's a place of tension. I had a really good editor, Jason Epstein at Random House, and he said, if you don't hold yourself in this tension on every page of this book, horror at his crime, but yet seeing his humanness, and you got to take your reader with you through the end in that tension.
Do you have to be a nun to do that? Do you need years of spiritual rigors to get to that place?
Spiritual rigors? I'm Cajun. I come from Louisiana. I don't know about the rigors part. You have to understand about dignity. And the lawyers who take these cases and people who understand about human rights, they all do this. It's certainly not being a nun that does it.
I want to go to the phones. We've got a lot of folks who want to talk to you. And we're going to start with Linda in Kennan. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I just wanted to thank Sister for writing the book. I read it out of more curiosity than anything else. And I wouldn't say as I closed the last page, but somewhere after I closed that last page, within 3 to 6 months, I totally changed my opinion. I got it, and I no longer felt that the death penalty was valid. And I've always wanted to thank her for that. It also taught me that it was, you know, you don't necessarily change your opinion on a dime, but something inside, just as you were just talking about the ending of that book, something inside just really must have spoken to me, and I just came away, and I never can support the death penalty again for anybody.
Thanks for sharing that, Linda. You know, most of us have to navigate through terribly ambivalent feelings, and I myself have, because when we hear about an innocent person being brutally killed, we're outraged. And that's ethical, I believe, to feel outrage at the wanton killing of an innocent human being. But then when you see what it means to say, now we're going to decide who are these people who are the worst of the worst, as the Supreme Court has told us we're supposed to do, and then kill them. When you come into this process of the guards and the people who have to do the killing to take that alive person out of that cell and walk them down and forcibly then throw them into a chair or gurney and kill them, then you ask yourself the question, well, what are we doing? And I began to realize it's much more about us and how it is that we're going to choose to respond.
Jake, did you go on a similar journey like that, where you had to examine your feelings about life and death and blame and capital punishment?
Absolutely. And my job as a composer is to go into the heart of every person that's in this drama and not judge them, empathize with them, so that I can find the music that resonates as truthful for that person and let the audience decide how they feel on it. Of course, I have my own feelings about it, but I have to set that aside and just look at the heart of each person, really as an actor inhabits a character, like what Susan Sarandon told you about acting.
The vocation of acting is enforced compassion. You
right.
get inside the skin and life of all different kinds of people
right.
and become them.
And you don't judge them. You just let them be. And what I find when I'm writing characters in an opera, like Dead Man Walking, is once I get into that heart, into that character, I start to feel music. And then it's really like taking dictation. It's not me telling them how it goes. They tell me how it goes. But you do have to get past a lot of, you know, personal obstacles that you may have set up in your own way.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So when you get to the heart of the person, then you start to hear the music.
Yeah.
Did you go through that process for every person in this opera?
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, I, like a lot of people, you hear that you're going to write music for a nun and you get a preconceived idea.
We go with the nun thing, man. Here we go.
You know? And then you talk to Sister Helen and you realize, oh, I can't do that. This is just a wonderful, fully dimensional, flesh and blood person, not just someone who wears a certain garb. And it was the same with the parents on either side. With the prison guard, the warden, with Joseph Desrochers himself. Joseph is the name of the character in the opera. But what I think is really important about the opera that's different from reading the book or seeing the movie is you're watching people, three-dimensional people, you know, open their hearts and tell their emotions, and you see the conflicts happen. We see the crime happen. We see the response to it, and we have music to take us on the journey and illuminate the emotional world of these people. And it becomes much more visceral and real in a way. And you are part of a community that's experiencing this with an audience of 2,000 people.
Well, we're speaking right now with the author of Dead Man Walking, Sister Helen Prejean, and the composer of the opera Dead Man Walking, Jake Heggie. The opera is being performed for the first time in Wisconsin through Madison Opera tonight and Sunday at the Overture Center.
You can join the conversation. Did you want to ask Sister Helen about her experience, about Dead Man Walking, about her activism against capital punishment? Do you want to ask about the opera? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back with the author of Dead Man Walking, Sister Helen Prejean, and the composer of Dead Man Walking, Jake Heggie. And that opera is being performed for the first time in Wisconsin by Madison Opera. It's showing tonight and Sunday at the Overture Center.
We'd like to hear from you. Do you have questions for Sister Helen about her experience or her activism against the death penalty? Have you read the book or maybe seen the opera? Call and tell us how the work has affected you at 800-642-1234 or send an email, talk@wpr.org.
And I'd like to get a little more music in. We've been hearing it sprinkled throughout, but this next clip, I wonder, Jake, if you could introduce it for us.
Sure. This takes place in the second act. It's between the character Sister Helen Prejean and the mother of the convicted killer, Joseph Desrochers. And Mrs. Desrochers has just said goodbye to her son for the last time. And she runs, after they take him out, she runs over and desperately calls out his name, and he's already gone. And she's thanking Sister Helen for seeing her son for who he is, not just the act that he committed. And they have this very short moment, this duet. And this is Joyce DiDonato and Frederica von Stade singing in Houston at the Houston Grand Opera.
Okay, here it is. And the mother of the murderer, Joseph Desrochers, in the opera there, singing with Sister Helen Prejean. And I know this is something that you've thought a lot about how we are all, in a sense, literally, you know, someone's child, yes, someone's parent, sometimes both. How do those relationships evolve, and how have you seen them evolve?
Well, that music just really brought me back to some of the real mothers who had to say goodbye to their children. These incredible scenes, you know, there could be a whole thing done just on mothers, because here your mother and your child has done an unspeakable act. Here your mother, who sees your child go out the door and says your last words to them, something about, honey, fix the hem of your skirt. And their great anguish. And it's so indescribable of what they go through. And just that little piece we played brought me back, like Willie Celestine. He was in the death house. His mother was there. He was saying goodbye. At the last minute, he got a stay of execution. And she wanted to hug him, and the guard wouldn't let her. And so I hugged her. And she's saying to me, sister, if I'd put my arms around my boy, no guard could have pried it loose. And I happened to look over her shoulder, and I caught the eyes of a guard. And his eyes were like flint, because he had hyped himself up for the execution of this man. And it's just unbelievable, the play of emotions and in conflict with each other. But mothers always go with their children, and the people who have done unspeakable crimes always want to believe that their mother loved them, and they go back to that mother's love, even if she had been, from other people's term or point of view, a very bad mother. It's incredible stuff, you know.
And how did you think about mothers, Jake?
Well, you hit the nail on the head when you said the opera really is about parents and children. And the surprise in the opera, I think, is we see the crime, and we see these beautiful young teenagers murdered. We meet Sister Helen. We meet Joseph. We know about we meet the parents of the murder victims. But the surprise is when Joseph's mother comes on, and people suddenly realize, because he's been described as a monster, you know, he'll never amount to anything. You'll never get anywhere with him. And suddenly you go, oh, he has a mother. Look, he has siblings. My gosh, she has a story too. And it suddenly opens it up to, you know, people, when you are a parent, you have an empathy for other parents in a way. Or when you're, you know, we're all the children of somebody. So it was a big perspective on the opera itself. And it's a theme that runs throughout the piece, including musical themes that are developed because of the parents. I think it's very important to note in this opera, though, that Terrence McAnally and I focused very much on telling a human drama, not trying to tell people how to feel. It is not a debate. The opera itself is not a debate on the death penalty. What it does is it presents a story that takes place under the umbrella of the death penalty is hovering in the background all the time, raising the stakes to life and death. But it's not that our piece is not there to tell you how to feel or how to think. It presents everybody's story. Everyone gets space, the mothers, the fathers, the children themselves. You see them several times through the opera, the ones that were murdered. Joseph, Helen, the sisters where she works. It's all perspective and all people giving their emotional reaction and information so that you, the audience, can not only experience the drama, but imagine yourself in a perspective maybe that you hadn't considered.
Raising a lot of questions along the way. Yes. Right, let's go back to our phones right now. We've got Nikki Jo, who is joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Nikki Jo.
Oh, hi. I am remembering what really struck me when I saw the movie many years ago, Sister Helen, and I don't know how this plays out in the opera or if it does at all, but the question I have is really about forgiveness. And I had this memory of the movie, this sense that it seemed important somehow for him to be honest about what he had actually done. And I'm actually in training as a spiritual director right now, so I really appreciate and can't imagine how you ministered so well to this young man and his family. But if you could just talk about forgiveness, how that plays out in the story or in the opera, and Jake, how that touched you in regard to music.
Hmm. All right, well, thank you. Very thoughtful questions there. Right. Helen,
okay, Nikki Jo, well, you know, with when I accompany people on death row, and they're going to be executed by the state, and you know, I don't let myself get so overpowered with that, and that's a wrong thing to do. They need to be and want to be authentic human beings. So part of it is for them to come to the place and to give them the love and safety to come to a place to acknowledge, so they can be honest with themselves. And I love the way it's caught in the opera that I quoted to one of them. Check out the Gospel of John. The truth will set you free, because he was dodging so many things, wasn't able to own things, blaming other people. And the truth will set you free. And then to come to that, but to have love, that he knows he's loved, and that he can acknowledge it. And that gives him the safety and the space to acknowledge, yeah, I did it. That's a very, very important dynamic in it. Forgiveness. For the victim's family, the big discovery I made was, and you know, and you see the victim's families are complex in the opera, also in the movie, starting off in this place of great anger, and some, like at the end of the film, the Percys leave the screen, they've witnessed the execution, they seem to have satisfaction from it, and it seemed to give them what they need. Others, just even watching the person be executed, it was still like, not enough. Or what would it take to be able to come to peace inside yourself that you have lost your child? And the greatest lesson I've learned from the victims' families in that is not to let the hatred and anger take over them, because then they'd be losing their own life as well. That forgiveness really meant a gift, first and foremost, that they gave themselves, not to be overcome by the hatred.
And Jake, how do you paint forgiveness in music?
Well, it's the tension of the entire opera, is not only that journey to forgiveness and love and a sense of redemption, but also that journey to the truth, which Sister Helen in her first aria in the opera starts to sing about, this journey to God, this journey to the truth and to this man. And by the time the opera is over, we've been building up to this moment of, will he confess to what he's done in these last minutes of his life? Will he be able to speak the truth to her and really find some kind of sense of peace for even acknowledging what he did? And that's the tension of the entire opera. And so once he does that, there's a new kind of musical language that can appear, because there's a new space of honesty and love that's created.
And we're running short of time, unfortunately. I feel like we could talk till the moon came up.
I just want to say one other thing about forgiveness. And one of the victims.
We've got a little bit of time. Go ahead.
One of the victims' family said to me, he said, you know, sister, people in our society think forgiveness is weakness. Mm. Like, oh, you kill my son, I forgive you means I condone what you did. And they see it as weakness. And he said, and I've had to work my way through that, that it's not weakness. But I found that actually for some, it was a way to honor my child, because my child was a loving child. And I couldn't ask for the death of someone else and honor my child. As he was.
I heard a phrase, the forgiveness doesn't make the other person right, it sets you free. Mm. And that's a big part of it too.
We've got about 30 seconds here. I want to ask you, you have seen things that most people hope never to see in their lifetime, and you're one of the most joyous people I've ever met. How is that?
I don't know. I just try to live my life and with love? I don't know. I don't know how to answer that question. I think joy is a byproduct of our lives. I don't think we can seek it. I just try to live with as much compassion as I know how, and I'm always learning from other people.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you both for coming and sharing this time with us.
Great pleasure
thank
to be
you.
Here.
Thank you. It was great to
We've
be
been
here.
Speaking to Sister Helen and Jake Hege. They are, Sister Helen wrote Dead Man Walking and Jake Hege, the opera version of Dead Man Walking, which is premiering in Wisconsin, at least, tonight at Madison Opera, showing again on Sunday.
We're joined by WPR's news director, Michael Leland, for a look at what's making headlines in Wisconsin this week.
Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's start with a law that Governor Walker signed. This one involves police-involved shootings. What happened?
Right. This is a new law. It affects mostly police departments in the state's largest cities, like Milwaukee, Madison, and Green Bay. Right now, when there's a police-involved shooting, they do their own investigation. Smaller communities for years have had this done by outside investigators already because, well, for the most part, they don't have the staffing needed to conduct such an investigation. So now under this law, all police-involved shootings have to be investigated by a group or organization outside of that particular police department.
And how did this law come about? Where did it come from?
Well, partly because of a man named Michael Bell. Back in 2004, his son was shot by police outside of their home in Kenosha. He sort of took it on as his cause when an internal investigation, again, this is the community investigating itself, the police department, found no wrongdoing by police. And that has really been the argument by supporters of this law and this effort that whether it's true or not, it can appear to be a conflict of interest for a police department to investigate itself.
And Michael Bell, the plaintiff you were just talking about, he used his megaphone and he's gotten some attention and obviously got some traction with this law. But what happened after?
Right. There was a civil lawsuit and he settled for a little bit under $2 million. And he used a lot of that money on things like billboards and other ways of publicizing his campaign, not only about his son, but also raising awareness about another case, this one in Milwaukee. The death of Derek Williams, who died while handcuffed in the back of a Milwaukee squad car in 2011. So attention started building, and the next thing you know, we've got legislation.
So now if the police aren't investigating these cases, who is when it's a police-involved shooting?
It could be other police departments. It could be the federal investigators. I mean, there are other outside organizations that can do this sort of thing.
And as far as support for this law, which legislators were attached to it? Where did the support come from?
Yeah, it was bipartisan. Representative Chris Taylor, a Democrat of Madison, and Gary Bies of Sister Bay, he's a Republican. They are the co-sponsors of the legislation, which not only includes the shootings, but it also requires that the details of these investigations be publicly released if there are no charges filed. And it goes into effect immediately.
Okay, well, now from a sign law to, I guess, a possible law down the road, Glenn Grothman calling for an end to race and gender preference programs in Wisconsin. Catch us up on that.
Right. This is something he's talked about in the past, but it sort of got new life or became something to be talked about again. Because as you remember, this past Tuesday, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in a Michigan case that a ballot initiative in that state that bans the consideration of race in public university admissions is constitutional. So shortly after that ruling was announced, really within hours, Glenn Grothman, a Republican state senator, said that he would reintroduce his bill to end all race and gender preference programs here in Wisconsin.
What has Grothman said so far about why he feels this is necessary?
Well, he has said, first of all, that he was already planning to do this, but now thinks it has a much greater likelihood of passing because of the Supreme Court ruling. He has said that race and gender preferences in society are extensive, more so than he says many people realize. And he says things like requiring that a certain percentage of public contracts be set aside for women and minority-owned businesses are divisive.
And what would it take to pass the law? Do we have a sense?
Yeah, this would be a constitutional amendment required. So this would be, not a short-term thing. It would have to pass two consecutive legislative sessions, then go to the voters, and then it would become part of the Constitution. So, again, we're talking several years before this could go into effect. And, again, he's brought this up in the past, but it has not gone anywhere.
Now, to be clear, how would you parse the ruling that the Supreme Court upheld? Does it weigh in on affirmative action either way?
Yeah, it doesn't really say much about or really anything about whether an admission policy that considers race is a good thing or not. It really just looked at the amendment that was passed in Michigan and said Were Michigan voters within their right to ban the use of that sort of policy? And the court said, yes, they were. So it was really about whether voters had the right to do what they did, not whether these policies were a good idea.
So a lot of people looking at that Supreme Court ruling, wondering how it's going to affect them. What about the UW?
Well, here in Wisconsin, UW has what it calls a holistic admission policies. It does consider race among a variety of factors when determining admission. It relies mainly on academic records, but again, considers a range of factors, including race. There is a legal group that's actually looking to possibly challenge that policy here in Wisconsin, and it has been looking for clients, people who have applied to the UW and were turned away for a potential lawsuit against the UW for its policy, but that could be a ways down the road.
All right, we'll be watching that one to come. And some breaking news in the gubernatorial race here in Wisconsin. It sort of seemed as though it was going to be Governor Walker with a leading candidate, Mary Burke, from the Democrats. Now we've got a new candidate.
Yep, Democrat Brett Halsey, a state representative from Madison, said this week he would be running for governor, and that would likely set up a primary with Democrat Mary Burke if he gets on the ballot. And we'll know more about that in about a month or so when all of that is locked in. Some Democrats had hoped to avoid a primary so that Burke wouldn't have to spend a lot more money up front. But Halsey says it would be good, obviously good for him if he wins. But even if he doesn't, he says a primary would be good for Burke because it would sharpen her campaign against Governor Walker for the November election.
And what do we know about what Halsey is running on so far?
Well, he says he wants to restore all of the funding that the governor cut from education in his first budget a few years ago. He also wants to turn some land up in northern Wisconsin, which is the subject of, whether there may be an iron ore mine there someday. He says that should just become a state park. And he also wants to overturn that Act 10 law that largely curtailed collective bargaining for public workers.
Give a sense of what his campaign is like so far.
Does it
match Burke's?
Yeah, he has described it as promising to be entertaining. It's largely a low budget campaign. So far, he says that's meant shooting internet campaign ads with his iPhone. Of course, he's got his Volkswagen Cabriolet or Golf, or perhaps you've seen that around town, and many people will be seeing that around the state, I'm sure.
All right. Well, that's another one that we'll be developing in the weeks and months to come. We'll be watching that. And in terms of Governor Walker himself and Mary Burke, we've got a new poll. What new information do we have?
Yeah, new poll this week from Public Policy Polling. This is a firm that polls for Democratic campaigns. It has found that Governor Walker leading Mary Burke by 3 percentage points, 48% to 45%, and 30% of voters at this point still saying they don't know enough about Burke to form an opinion. And again, these results were within the poll's margin of error, which was plus or minus about 3 percentage points.
Well, we are clearly in the thick of election season. It will get, I guess, thicker.
Yes.
More active.
Yeah, more active.
So we'll be watching that. But that's what we know this week about the gubernatorial race. Now to look at Milwaukee in particular, they are looking at a gun buyback program. Tell us about that.
Right. Unfortunately, summer brings more people out into the streets and can increase violence. And we all remember last summer in August, there were 20 people shot and killed in Milwaukee. Another 80 were shot and wounded. Milwaukee mayor is trying to prevent a repeat of that sort of violence. He says the city's going to hold another gun buyback program on May 17th. There was one back in 2005 that brought in about 3,000 firearms, and the mayor obviously is hoping to get a lot more guns off the street this time around.
So it's been a while. Where did the idea come from this time?
Our Chuck Kornbach this week reported that the idea came from a metal recycling firm owner named Marty Foreman. And Foreman says he'd like to see the guns melted and then made into garden tools, sort of a modern take on the swords into plowshares thing. He says so far they've raised about $75,000 for the buyback program.
So what other support have we seen aside from Mayor Barrett, who wants to hold this thing?
Well, it's not just obviously the mayor and Mr. Foreman. There have been a group of African-American clergy in the city who have been asking for quite a while for another gun buyback program. One of them said that even if you've got criminals who don't turn in their guns, even if many people don't turn in their guns, which is likely going to happen, the buyback program still promotes safety because they say it encourages other people in the community to do constructive things like create jobs and really gives hope to people. So it can be a positive thing even in areas of the city that may not see as many guns come off the street as the organizers hope.
And gun violence is something that the news department has been tracking, right?
Yeah, we have been keeping an eye on the number of gun homicides in the state just really to get a sense of the scope of the problem. So we've been sort of keeping track this year. At last count, there have been 29 people killed in gun-related homicides in the city. I mean, in the state. This is a statewide number. And, of course, we'll continue to follow on that and report on issues related to gun violence throughout the year.
Excellent. Well, Michael, thank you so much for coming by. I appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
That was WPR's news director, Michael Leland.